Super Talk Mississippi Media Production.
This is Gerard Gibbert, and thank you for listening to Middays here on Super Talk Mississippi.
Show was previously recorded.
Middays with Gerard Gibbert is on the air. Middays with Gerard Gibbert is powered by C Spire. Power your home or business with C Spire fiber. To learn more, visit supertalk.fm/C Spire. C Spire fiber powers Super Talk Mississippi.
Get ready. Get ready to go beyond the headlines and join a meaningful conversation with people from around the state. Hello. You're listening to Middays with Gerard Gibbert here on Super Talk Mississippi.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to Midday Super Talk Mississippi. I'm your host, Gerard Gibbert, along with Rhino in the Element Wealth Studio, guiding you through the middle of your day with facts, fodder, and fine music on this
Friday Eve.
We kick off the program this morning with Jessica Corley, Vice President of Development, Palmer Home for Children. Hey, Jessica.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
You bet. So start out, Jessica, just for the benefit of our audience that might not be familiar with the Palmer Home for Children, exactly what is it? What's your mission? What services do you provide? What do you guys do?
Absolutely. So Palmer Home for 130 years has been providing quality care for the most vulnerable of children who come from traumatic situations, are vulnerable, and just need our support and a safe place to call home.
Right. And we're going to be up there for the annual Radiothon, July the 10th. That's an all-day affair. All the shows will be on site at the Palmer Home for Children. That's on Super Talk Mississippi every year. And, of course, we'll set some financial targets, and we'll try to eclipse those targets. And if we at least achieve them, my partner Rhino here is going to get a new coif, and he's going to lose that beard at least for a year. He'll grow it back for next year. So we're up there on the 10th. How important is that to the Palmer Home for Children?
I feel grateful for Super Talk and all the Super Talk listeners. For 13 years, this has been a largest fundraiser for us and has raised over $3 million for our ministry. So we're incredibly grateful, and it's absolutely vital for our mission.
So in addition to that, we always are fascinated and so pleased to meet some of the Palmer Home families. These are their parents, right, that offer the opportunity for these children to take residence in their home sometimes and take care of them, or they're at the Palmer Home as well. These are people that just volunteer for this.
Yes, in my mind, our caregivers, our house parents, they are all domestic missionaries. They, many of them live on our campus and can have up to 8 children in their home, including their own biological children. And they just show them love, normalcy, stability, provide a safe, loving family for them, and help these children grow to become the best versions of themselves as possible.
Something that the CEO, Drake Bassett, talks about with regularity is that those of us out here in a situation, a typical kind of normal life, if you will, don't have to worry about where our next meal's coming from. But some of these children, before they get into the Palmer Home, that's literally a stressful part and an unknown part of their life.
Exactly. It's heartbreaking, but so many kids come to us struggling with food insecurity. And, you know, we have trauma-informed care and training for our caregivers to know how to help that child overcome that insecurity, how to know that their next meal is coming, it will be provided. Palmer Home, we will take care of them, and that's one less thing they have to worry about and can just be kids. they deserve to just be kids and not have to worry about that. And through our Whole Child Initiative, we see the whole child story and we create a plan for each individual child to meet them at their needs, where they've been, what they've gone through, and to make sure that we have a plan in place to provide them with the skills and comfort that they need, especially with food insecurity issues.
Right. And you're so right. No child should have to worry about where their next meal is coming from. I mean, that's pretty fundamental. That's a minimum. And in a country such as ours with such incredible bounty, no child should obviously be left behind in that regard. So what's the goal, Jessica? You guys run into these children that are in some difficult situations, need some help, need that nurturing, that loving upbringing and environment. What's the goal, though, as they advance through their years?
First step is gaining their trust, helping them know that they are safe and cared for, and they can put their guard down, that they don't need to be in survival mode anymore. That's step one. And then we continue to walk through the Whole Child Initiative, and creating an individualized plan for each child so that they can grow and not only survive but thrive. We create education plans specific to them, health plans specific to them, so they can just be the best version of themselves and have hope for their future, where so many of them did not before. So many of them saw the cycles of their family and their past and did not know there was opportunity out there beyond that. We have so many students who are the first in their family to ever graduate high school this past May, and that was just a beautiful thing to see. And then not only just graduate high school, but go on to trade school or college. And just the confidence and hope that gives them is so, so meaningful.
Yeah, and you've got a long track record of success, does Palmer Home for Children, in that respect, where so many of these children were taken in, just needed that comfort, that security, and that just visibility into their future, knowing that I don't have to worry about where my meal's coming from. I can focus on being a child and getting an education. And then they advance through that, go on to bigger and better things once they're done with the Palmer Home, or certainly done as far as being a child in the Palmer Home. Many of them stay in touch with you, come back.
Oh, yes. Once a part of the Palmer Home family, always a part of the Palmer Home family. In fact, we're one of the rare organizations that see these children beyond 18 and up. So we have our transitional care program where we continue to coach and mentor these kids up until their young adulthood to ensure that they're successful contributing members of our community here in Mississippi.
Yeah. And I think it says a lot about the quality of the services, the care provided in the Palmer Home for Children during their tenure there, if they're willing to come back and still maintain those relationships, because I've interviewed some of them, and they build these very strong relationships with sometimes their house families, and often it also extends into the staff there at Palmer Home, and they come back and maintain those relationships.
They do. It's a beautiful thing. And we're so grateful for all of our incredible caregivers. We're grateful for our Whole Child Initiative that we've created and launched that not only helps our mission, but other missions throughout the country in trauma-informed care.
So just so our audience will know, Jessica, funding for Palmer Home for Children, where does that come from?
100% comes from private donations. So from your listeners, from individuals, organizations, businesses, we receive zero government funding. And that allows us to remain privately funding and independent to care for these children in a holistic, individualized manner and to share the love of God with them at the same time.
Yeah, no doubt about it. So contributions are tax deductible to Palmer Home?
Absolutely. You can go to palmerhome.org, click on the donate button, or you can email us at development@palmerhome.org, and we'll be happy to answer any questions and share more of the impact you can make through our mission.
How many children do you know off the top of your head there, Jessica, are in your care right now?
Oh, goodness. Somewhere between 30 and 40 right now. It ebbs and flows. You know, we always aim for reunification when it's possible. And so we've got some kids home for the summer, and it may be a temporary thing while mom or dad are working towards getting back on their feet and recovering. So it's constantly changing, but typically between that range. But we serve close to 300 children each year. Okay. I think it was around 268 last year.
Gotcha.
Because so many kids are in our care beyond our campus.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, before we go, one of the things that Rhino and I always observe is lunchtime. When the kids come in, often with their brothers and sisters and their house families and caregivers, and they're so polite and they're so excited, they're so enthusiastic. It's just good to see them in a thriving, happy, fun environment, which is what all kids deserve. It's big time.
Absolutely.
Appreciate it, Jessica.
Appreciate you all so much.
You bet. We'll see you there in a few weeks. Jessica Corley, Vice President of Development, Palmer Home for Children. Thanks a lot. We're coming right back in the Element Well studio.
This show was previously recorded.
Hey, can you blow up some balloons?
This show was previously recorded.
This segment of Middays with Gerard Gibbert is brought to you by Covington County Hospital in Collins, where your health matters.
Now back to Middays with Gerard here on Super Talk Mississippi.
Welcome back, everyone. A little Huey Lewis in the news bumping us into this segment of Middays. We're in the Element Well studio, welcoming now Haley Fisackerly, President and CEO of Entergy Mississippi. Haley, always good to see you. Thanks for coming in.
Good morning, Gerard. Thank you. Appreciate the opportunity to come and talk to your audience and our customers.
Yes, sir. You bet. And I'm one of them.
Yes.
And a happy customer as well. So we appreciate all the great work that you and your team do. So, you guys have been busy. You're in the process of constructing significant expansion in capacity and transmission to accommodate this unbelievable investment in terms of new economic projects in our state, specifically in Madison County, just a few miles north of our location here. We've got Amazon Web Services,
right,
slated to build out two hyperscale data center campuses. And, of course, critical, essential to that project was your company's ability to meet their electricity demands.
Oh, that's right. Gerard, it is exciting, and it's something I like to tell people. AWS threw us a lifeline at a critical time when we're going to have to make significant investments in serving our existing customers. A third of our generation was set to retire in the next few years. Hmm. We have to make huge investments to better serve our customers, both reliably and through resiliency due to storms. And this opportunity, thanks in big part from Madison County and the leadership they showed and the governor and others to help bring this, it is happening, though. It is amazing. I drove out there just last week, five buildings already vertical, and we've already provided power to them now. And so they're slowly ramping. They're not do that. As you're familiar, it's it phases in three phases over 3 years. So phase one, their buildings are up. They're putting the equipment in. Phase two is under construction on County Line Road. And so a lot. So it's definitely had us busy. We delivered the first substation 2 months ahead of schedule this past December and started ramping power to them in February.
Okay.
The second substation on the Costas property is under construction now, and the third one back at Canton is also started clearing of that land too. So very busy. We broke ground on the Delta Blues power station in Greenville, and now we're working through a process to get a power plant approved in Ridgeland right now as well.
Okay, so I didn't realize you guys were already providing power to those buildings.
In a very slow ramp.
Okay,
it's a ramp over time and all that, but they are. We they are hooked up and slowly ramping up.
Yeah. So.
And providing benefits to customers.
Oh, that's fantastic. So you're probably aware that this project proposes 16 buildings total at this point.
Yep.
We think there's going to be a lot more. I know you're aware of that as well. But at least for now, 16 buildings, about 250,000 square foot facilities each building. There are two different sites. One, as you just mentioned, the Costas property here in Ridgeland, or just north of our location in Ridgeland, across the county line there. And then the other further north in Madison County in Canton, the Canton mega site, 16 total buildings. You guys are investing a bunch, though. I mean, do you know right now, Haley, what the total capital investment will be for new generation and transmission?
Well, this one will just be just over close to $3 billion between all of it.
Okay.
Now, the thing that we're investing, and people need to understand, AWS is paying the incremental cost to serve them. And so the huge benefits that our customers are getting, for example, the transmission lines serving those sites have to be upgraded to larger standards, more resilient standards, improving the flow of power into this metropolitan area. Those substations that have to be built to serve those are being paid incrementally by the customer. They are capital investments in it. But the tariff, the rate that they're paying through that covers those incremental costs, but it creates the economies of scales.
Yeah.
That's going to create the huge benefit to the rest of our customers. And that's a real benefit there at a time where we need to make significant investment to improve service.
Explain that, Haley. A little further, you're aware that there are some who have expressed significant concerns about possible rate increases to just a standard consumer to offset what is, I guess, been reported at least as a significant discount to AWS, that in fact the consumers are going to have to pay to offset that discount you guys are selling power to AWS for. Right. Talk about that.
Well, keep in mind, large customers like this, large volume users, you know, they do get a rate discount because of volume.
Yeah.
But their total contribution, because of the volume, is tremendously great. So keep that in mind. But like a second of all, they do pay the incremental costs, the parts that do not benefit the rest of customers to serve themselves. So on top of that, when you get that type of volume coming in, though, the rest of the benefits of that and the cost that they do contribute toward benefiting other customers. The legislation and the requirement the governor, the lieutenant governor, the speaker, and the Public Service Commission required is that they cover the incremental costs and provide extra economic benefit to customers.
Okay.
So what we're seeing going forward, they will be providing of the investments we were going to have to make to serve our customers regardless of AWS, they're going to be covering over 50% of that going forward.
Okay.
And so like the Delta Blues plant, and we had to build that. Now with a large customer, they're going to be paying a larger amount of the freight to cover that, which is going to produce that. And so after we see, now rates are going to go up, but we have seen the trajectory of future rate increases cut in half.
Hmm.
Because of AWS's presence going forward on that. And that's going to be the huge benefit providing our customers and allow us to start making the investments to better serve our customers and communities.
So at least one detractor, however, has described the legislation as giving Amazon Web Services essentially a blank check to buy electricity from Entergy. Is that the case?
No, that is not the case. We, after the legislature passed the legislation, then we had, and we knew the parameters and what the law says, then we sat down to negotiate the contract on these first three phases and these first three phases only. And that's where these parameters were addressed. This is where the cost, the incremental cost that they have to pay is addressed, and the benefits they provide to customers through rate stabilities that we're able to give our customers and make those investments. There is talk about, could they do more? Yes, they bought plenty of land. That anything beyond that is a separate deal.
Okay.
So there's no blank check. This is tied to those first 16 buildings, and if there's any more beyond that, well, they have to meet the parameters as laid out by that legislation and provide value to all customers.
The Public Service Commission, of course, regulates the energy utility industries in our state, and it's being reported that the PSC has no oversight over this particular project. Explain that for us.
Well, that's the part that makes me a little nervous, because that's not true. What's different is they had to speed up the front end part. You know, for this opportunity to come to Mississippi, if it could not have been delivered in 3 years, it was gone.
Yeah,
it was
that's gone. Right.
So how do you speed up through the permitting and review process? So it granted the convenience of necessity, that we need a certificate of convenience and necessity, CCNs, but every project, each substation, each transmission stuff, each power plant, every one of those, as they are completed, they go in front of the commission for a prudency review. The legislation allowed the PSC to hire a third-party independent to review those.
Okay.
If they find anything improper or imprudent, it can be disallowed.
Okay.
Under old processes, we would have that agreed upon and approved before we would go make those investments. Under this process, this prudency has to come on the back end. And so that's a little nerve-wracking. So we're going to have to do a lot of work on the front end to prove and show what we're doing to manage the costs and finding the best processes going forward.
So, Haley, are they bringing in third parties, and did this come about because of just the scale, the magnitude, the complexity of this? It just makes sense to bring in folks with a greater set of expertise to be involved?
Keep in mind, the Public Service Commission is very busy, and their staff are constantly doing their day-to-day work of regulating the retail utilities in the state. So when you bring this extra burden of work in, it provides them additional hands, because it is incremental, right? These filings will be made that. We also have to provide reporting throughout the year to the staff and the commission on the progress of these projects. So if anything, it provides more oversight. There are lots of projects that have come to this state in different parts of the state. You've never seen anything that has as much scrutiny as this one does.
Okay. The assertion that the legislature repealed Entergy's ability to raise rates by more than 4% per year.
No, they did not repeal that. We have what we call a former rate plan. It's performance-based rate making. And at any time during the course of a year, if revenues exceed by 4% the previous year, they go in for a review.
I see.
They are bringing so much revenue in, their revenue exceeds the 4%. And a good example, we had a former rate plan that just went in front of the commission just 2 weeks ago.
Yeah.
Just off of the forecast, we're seeing it for the first time in 6 years, there was not adjustment under the former rate plan.
Can you hang with us another segment?
Sure, you bet.
We got a break right now. We got Haley Forsakerly, President and CEO of Entergy Mississippi, coming right back in the Element Well studio.
This show was previously recorded.
You're listening to Middays with Gerard Gibbert, here on Super Talk Mississippi.
We're back in the Element Well studio. Haley Forsakerly, President and CEO of Entergy Mississippi, is our guest. So, Haley, you've seen reports across the country where this massive build-out of data centers, which are, of course, huge consumers of electricity, have caused rates to go up in certain areas. Virginia is one that comes to mind. There's a huge concentration of data centers there. But it looks to me like, on all the research I've done, I want you to comment on this, that the power companies didn't properly plan for this explosion, and now they're kind of caught with their shorts off here.
So true. I mean, this happened so quickly. You know, when we first started talking to AWS 7 years ago, it was really just around data storage.
That's right.
And the whole machine learning AI came after that. But you hit the nail on the head. We were not a first mover, but we were definitely we were the second mouse that got the cheese. We were able to see that, and I think the legislation, the process, and the policies we put forth in there allow us to capture these opportunities, but at the same time do in a way that truly benefits our customers and our communities and protects them. I mean, this is transformational. It's generational. I mean, just based off, as you know, the $10 billion known, it was estimated that nearly $80 million in ad valorem taxes to Madison County. never mind the fact the investments we're making are going to be in five other counties.
That's $80 million a year, folks, by the way.
$80 million a year.
Yeah.
And we're making investments in power plants, solar facilities, transmissions in five other counties. And now, not nearly as big, but
yeah,
still incremental ad valorem taxes that are going to be transformational to schools and infrastructure locally. And
yeah,
so it's a real opportunity.
Okay. Well, are you prepared then to say here, Haley, that you don't expect that there will be any significant rate increases as has been asserted out there in the public as a result, direct result of this AWS project?
As a direct result, no. You know, rates were definitely going up, but as I said, because of bringing this new customer in, the volume, it changes that trajectory.
Okay.
And so rates will not be higher than they otherwise would have been.
Yeah.
And because we're dealing with fluctuation, you know, we saw steady increases in our rates since post-COVID because of materials, supply chain, inflation, labor costs, things of that nature. And this past year, finally, we saw that trajectory just change.
But as a regulated utility, you can't increase rates without the PSC approving it,
exactly,
right?
Exactly.
And then this past year, I think I just read not too long ago, you did not request a rate increase. Is that right?
That's correct.
For the next year.
For the next year. So the first time under our formal rate plan, it did not. And so, you know, there's lots of things that hit the fuel costs or a dollar-for-dollar pass-through. And so you've seen natural gas prices go up. And
yeah,
that's a significant part of everybody's bill. Nearly 50 cents of every dollar just goes to pay a fuel bill.
Okay.
So that will cause fluctuation. Weather changes the amount you use that. Taxes, regulations, and material costs.
Yeah.
We've definitely seen that. But one benefit that did allow us by this project moving as quickly as it did, in 1 year, we have seen components on power plants increase by 50% because of this nationwide demand for turbines and equipment. And so by moving early, we were able to lock down the supply chain on that and giving huge customers. Because like I said, we were going to build this plant anyway. Because of AWS, we're able to move more quickly with it. And provide those benefits as well. So it's a huge benefit. We're seeing demand too, though. It's not just data centers. We're seeing onshoring, manufacturing. We're seeing a way we use power, electrification. We're a more connected society and world today. We
no
carry
doubt.
Devices today.
All our homes are all wired up to the hilt with all kinds of stuff, which is a good thing.
And every time you hit an app on here, it's generating more use. If you're using AI-generated searches, they're going to use 10 times more electricity as normal.
Yep.
So we, the consumer, are changing that too. We could have sat back and said, hey, you know what, so what, we got to make these capital investments anyway. You got to take it, customers. No, we decided, how do we find something transformative that moves the needle and can partner with our customers and communities to help reduce the cost to serve?
Okay. In the new investments you're making, Haley, to accommodate, you said you had to do it anyhow, but my guess is the scale of that probably changed once you knew you had AWS coming in, right?
So, right. Well, we have to build more hardened facilities, storm resiliency stuff. The incremental things to serve them are going to be the substations, the solar facilities that they require. They want to be served by solar.
Yep.
Those things are incremental. The power plant that we needed here was going to be needed to serve our customers going forward because we were retiring units that in the future that had to be replaced. Our customers didn't need all of them, but now they have a partner in them, and we can build them at economy scales here that provide huge benefits to that going forward.
Makes sense.
It's a real win-win for our customers.
So you talked about natural gas. Are you going to power these facilities with gas turbines? I know that's kind of the more common way and more modern way of producing electricity these days, meaning your main source of energy will be natural gas. Is that true?
So keep in mind, when any customer is served, they join the grid.
Okay.
So, yes, we are adding more gas generation. We're adding solar. We have nuclear on our system. All of those things are in that, and it's in a pool, and you pull from that pool to meet your needs. So, yes, the incremental investments we're making are in some gas units, solar facilities. We had the opportunity to also acquire additional output out of Grand Gulf that belonged to one of our sister companies under a sharing agreement.
Yep.
That's been turned over to Mississippi, and we picked up that incremental load there. We have a partnership with Cooperative Energy. helping us meet some of the capacity as we ramp up and build our new units. So it was a real partnership there and doing that as well to make sure we're protecting customers and meeting the needs to grow.
So if the president's policies do affect the way it is expected, we might see the price of natural gas continue to decline, which would be good for the cost of generating electricity. Is that true?
You know, it's interesting. I think you're going to have upward pressure, Gerard, if you think about it, because there's so many gas units being built all over the country right now. LNG facilities are being built and upgraded. Our sister companies in Texas and Louisiana are serving two of the largest LNG facilities that are going through massive expansions to export natural gas. So I think it is going to have some pressures. However, I was at a conference just a few weeks ago, and the head of Occidental and also some other executives from the gas industries and commodity experts were forecasting what I thought were, you know, 50 cents to a dollar type increases. Now, you know, that is still some, but I still think of the days in the early 2000s when we saw $10 and $12 an MMBTU.
Yeah.
Forecasts now are in that $4 to $5 range,
okay,
which is still up. But the units we're building are more efficient. So the Delta Blues unit is nearly 50% more efficient than the one it's retiring. The one we're retiring is at a 14,000 heat rate. This one is less than 7,000. So you get more output with less gas. So that creates a huge efficiencies and savings to customers, too.
And there's also efficiencies in the IT gear as well. You know, AWS has said, hey, look, because of advances in power draw technology of all this equipment, we're going to be able to install more equipment and still draw the same amount of power, which is good for us because that means more ad valorem taxes and more investment and so forth.
Exactly. I saw where NVIDIA projected that they could see a 90% improvement in efficiencies in
yeah.
those. What you mean is they're going to just be able to put more
that's
processors
right.
into those
more
buildings.
Dense. Yeah.
Yeah, that's right.
So concerns that you've heard in the public about solar, talk about that and how that's consuming land and just other issues people have with it.
Well, you know, I've definitely heard that. You know, a lot of people think of it's impacting agriculture, and you're seeing some of that happen. It's starting to plateau somewhat now, I think.
Okay.
Economics, the big, beautiful bill is going to have a huge impact on that when the production tax credit's there. But so far, what we've been able to do, for at least from our side, serving our customers, is where it makes sense and when customers are willing to pay for that incremental cost.
Okay.
And that ensures that it's done in the right way. You know, we're still paying the ad valorem taxes, seeking a slight fee in lieu. There are some counties that have been using the full 90% that the legislator granted.
Yep.
So they probably won't see quite that, but at least it comes at the bottom end. But it does provide those benefits. But I think the concern is not as great as people should have, you know, and I think the contracts behind them, the way to build these in a way that's responsible and also to clean them, to decommission them later in life are there.
Still being debated, but are there any provisions, Haley, in the big, beautiful bill that could translate into higher rates for Mississippians and for your customers?
Well, for example, into our forecast, under the previous law, you have production tax credits around nuclear,
yeah.
around renewables. The power plants we are building will be using carbon capture capabilities. There's production tax credits for those. There's various supply chains. There's excise taxes if certain percentage of your supplies are foreign owned.
Yeah.
That's concerning because I appreciate trying to drive onshoring, but right now a lot of the materials come from foreign countries, so those excise taxes could drive our cost up. That's concerning. So we're trying to watch it all. It's still in the sausage making process, and we'll see where it shakes out.
But before we go, when it lands, if that necessitates a rate increase legitimately under our law, you still got to get approval by the PSC, right?
Still has to review. We have to show them why those.
You have to justify it.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right. And that's outside the. Yeah, that's a normal course of business.
That's just being a part of a regulated utility.
That's right.
Yeah. Haley Fisackerly is the president and CEO of Entergy in Mississippi. Thanks for coming in, Haley.
Thanks,
Enjoyed
Gerard.
It.
Yeah, appreciate it. Thank you.
We're coming right back, folks, in the Element Well studio.
This show was previously recorded.
Patriotism is a...
This show was previously recorded.
Come on.
God.
Middays with Gerard Gibbert.
All right, we are back
on Super Talk Mississippi.
Welcome back, everyone. It's Middays. We're coming at you from the Element Well studio. So, Senator Elissa Slotkin from the great state of Michigan, not a big fan of the big, beautiful bill, it's fair to say. And, you know, we've been talking quite a bit about how it seems like the central theme of the objection by Democrats to the bill is the changes to health care reforms. So listen to what Senator Slotkin says.
I did a little math. If you're a family of four in Lansing, Michigan, making a total of $129,000 total, and you're on the Obamacare ACA marketplace, your bill will go up by $5,500 next year. That's a 52% increase in your health care bills. If you are Joe and Nancy from Lansing, Michigan, 60 years old, your kids are out of the house, they're grown, you make $82,000 a year total between the two of you, your health care costs, if you're on the marketplace, will go up by $13,000. That is a 197% increase in your health care bills. So what are Joe and Nancy going to do? Are you going to pay for health care if it goes up by 197%? Think of your own health care. No. Joe and Nancy are going to be at risk for being off health care. And the combined cuts between Medicaid and Obamacare and the price of everyone else's insurance going up, we believe that enough people are going to be kicked off that it's going to feel really close to 2010, when the number one cause for bankruptcy in the United States of America was medical debt because people don't have insurance.
So, you know, I've often talked about how these politicians take advantage. That's a bunch of numbers and figures in that discussion, right? And most people just, boop, just glaze over. And they take advantage of the fact that most people really don't know what she's talking about, except they did key in on, wow, my insurance is going up $7,000 or whatever it was, the first example.
I think it was
$13,000. Okay. So I think that's right. It's a family of four example. She did a family of four, then a couple, then an individual. So, but it lacks context, as the left likes to say. And I'm going to explain it to you. First, you hear those numbers, like, where did she come up with that figure? Like the, I don't remember the exact, like $129,000 or something like that for the family of four. And that kind of triggered a little memory in my head and started doing the research on this yesterday. So here's the explanation. That happens to be exactly 400% of the federal poverty level. Why is that important? Because the way the subsidies are structured in the ACA marketplaces, the so-called Obamacare exchanges, where you can buy coverage and receive a subsidy from the government to pay for it, and it's calculated to limit your out-of-pocket premium cost to a percentage of your income, starting at 100% of the federal poverty level up to 400%. But if you make a dollar more than 400%, you lose the subsidy. That's known as the subsidy cliff, is what it's referred to. This is a bit timely because we got Leah coming in from the Mississippi Hospital Association next. But what she's saying is that Joe Biden's Inflation Reduction Act and then the American Rescue Plan, actually I got them reversed, the American Rescue Plan and then the Inflation Reduction Act, both pieces of legislation that passed early on in the Biden term, they reform the way the subsidy cliff works. Basically said, you can keep buying insurance on the exchanges even if your income is above 400% of the federal poverty level, and we will still limit the premiums to whatever it is, I think 9.5% of your household income. That's what she's talking about. Now, here's the important point. All that expires, by the way. In those two bills, it was passed in the American Rescue Plan, and then it was extended in the Inflation Reduction Act. That's scheduled to expire at the end of this year. Why? Because it passed with the supermajority instead of the supermajority, the filibuster-proof, 60 votes in the Senate, and it had to limit it to pass under Elizabeth McDonough, the parliamentarian's rules. Here's the deal. All we're doing here by allowing it to expire, Rhino, is returning to the original Obamacare policies. So now are you saying, Senator Slotkin and your Democrat colleagues, that Obamacare had bad provisions in it?
Sure seems like it.
What a hypocrite! You think she's going to explain this as I just did to the people?
No.
Not no, but hell no. I'm not even sure she can, because you watch the video, she's reading from a piece of paper that her staff gave her, right?
Yep.
She has no idea. She's just spouting numbers off. No idea the underlying reasons for why that's going to occur. So we're simply returning to Obama-era Obamacare, and they're mad about it. Fox News, Super Talk News next, then Leah Smith. Stay with us.
This show was previously recorded. Your show was previously recorded.
This hour of Middays with Gerard Gibbert is brought to you by the Mississippi Business Journal. Visit msbusinessjournal.com. Scott Coopwood, publisher and president.
And now, the talk that keeps Mississippi talking.
That's what I like to listen to.
You're listening to Middays with Gerard Gibbert. Here on Super Talk Mississippi.
Welcome back, everyone. It's hour two of Middays, live from the Element Well studio. Just watching on the screen here in the studio. Looks like the Senate is getting sort of configured there, Rhino, to take a vote, pass the bill. Now, what happens after that when it goes to conference? Who knows at this point? But we're pleased to welcome now Leah Smith, General Counsel and Vice President for Policy and Advocacy for the Mississippi Hospital Association. Hey, Leah, thanks for coming in.
Good morning. I'm so glad to be here.
All right. So we're glad to have you. So a lot of provisions in the big, beautiful bill, all 940 pages of it. It did shrink when it came from the House. It was over 1,000 pages. It's now below the 1,000-page mark. But much of the provisions of this bill, outside of all the various tax language, concern health care.
That's
something that affects your members, the members of the Mississippi Hospital Association, the hospitals not only in Mississippi, but, of course, across the country. So I'm sure your members, your organization, you're watching this closely,
yeah,
and there's some things you guys are concerned about.
We do have some concerns, and we've been talking to the delegation. And look, I just want to start by saying they've been great. This is my first year on federal advocacy with the Hospital Association, and the number one thing I want to say is our staffers up in D.C. are amazing. They're polite, and they do all the right things in that regard, but they're also so knowledgeable. And so we have been back and forth and talking to them, and there have been things that have changed in the bill, even in the Senate, from the Senate Finance Committee language that was really problematic, that have changed since then because of our advice and because of our conversations. So I think the first thing we would want to say is just thank you.
Okay.
Beyond that, we have some different concerns. The bill, you know, really does impact expansion states more. So you've got some
Medicaid expansion.
That's right.
Of which we're not one. There are 10 that have not expanded. We're one that hasn't.
That's right. So those states that have expanded for able-bodied adults, those are the ones that are going to see some real big pinches. But we have some too. And top of the list is our state-directed payment program. So the way that the bill reads currently, which it is changing. I think the parliamentarian right now is looking at handwritten changes. So
it just passed, by the way, in the Senate. It literally just announced.
It did?
What was, as drafted, just announced.
Okay, yeah. Well, I'm...
Literally just happened while we're sitting here. I'm watching it on the screen.
Well, I'm very hopeful that we're going to be talking about the right provisions because we don't really know. But that being said, yeah. what was in the bill about a half an hour ago when I read it?
Okay.
Some provisions that would take our state-directed payment program rate down from the average commercial rate to 110% of the Medicare rate starting in 2028. That's better than the Senate Finance Committee language, which started that step down in 2027. It's not as good as the House language, which would have grandfathered in our average commercial rate. And just to give you some context, when the state-directed payment program, the MHAP program, really started in 2015, we were pulling in about $500 million out of that program. And when it blew up in 2023, many thanks to Governor Reeves, who instructed the division to look at some new studies and piggyback off of some things going on in Louisiana.
And Florida. Yep.
Blew up that program. We're now pulling in $1.5 billion because of the average commercial rate. So it's a big deal.
Yeah.
And stepping back down to Medicare is going to mean hundreds of millions of dollars in losses.
Yeah, so just I'll attempt to explain it. Correct me if I don't get this right. But essentially, you got three major payers, commercial insurance, Medicare, Medicaid, and they don't all pay the same rates for the same services.
That's right.
In general, in that order, commercial pays more than Medicare, which pays more than Medicaid. And many providers, including hospitals, say we actually lose money every time we provide services that are claimed under Medicaid, reimbursed under Medicaid.
That's exactly
below cost.
That's exactly right. And so for years we were under reimbursed for many, many patients. And so what happened in 2023 was really kind of a truing up of even what we had been under reimbursed in the past. And since then, again, thanks to Governor Reeves, we've been able to do things like open service lines, keep the doors open, hire a doctor or do all of those sorts of things. So stepping back down to 110% of the Medicare rate, which is what we would be at because we're a non-expansion state.
Right.
Expansion states would be at 100% of the Medicare rate, is really going to hurt.
Hmm.
We do get a runway, which hospitals like. We like to know when things are going to happen. So at least we know we've got until 2028 and then we start stepping down. But it is going to mean hundreds of millions of dollars gone when we are up to $600 million a year in uncompensated care. We've climbed back up to $600 million.
Yeah, I didn't know that. It wasn't too long ago. It seemed like it was $400.
It is climbing and it just continues to go that way.
Okay, so now let's explain this to the folks. Hospitals do receive some money from the federal government. It's called disproportionate share.
That's right.
Shorthand for it is DSH payments, is how it's referred to in the industry. And basically, it's when the federal government looks at your patient balance, your payer mix or non-payer mix, and they'll send you some money because you have an outsized amount of Medicare, Medicaid, or uninsured relative to commercial, right?
That's right.
Did I explain that correctly?
You're absolutely correct. And we get about $30, $40 million from that. We will lose that beginning this year.
Okay.
Those will be stepped down. There'll be a big reduction there. The House language actually included some provisions that stepped that back to beginning in 2028, so we would have gotten a little more reprieve.
Okay.
So that's another smaller financial hit, is that DSH will begin to go away in September.
All right, so state-directed payments and then DSH payments possibly cut some holes in reimbursement to hospitals, your members. Let's talk about the changes in the provider tax and how that might affect Mississippi.
So less concerning.
Yeah.
And we are grateful for what the Senate did, which is grandfather in our rate.
Right.
So there's a 6% safe harbor in federal law. So federal law already dictates and puts limits on provider taxes. That limit is at 6%. We are about, couple tenths of a percentage point away from 6%. So we are almost to the limit.
Okay.
I think there are some questions about that language and the CMS regs and what will happen if we want to restructure that, for example. And we might need to restructure some things depending on what happens with this big, beautiful bill. We might need to change up some things. And hospitals are very used to that. But so we don't know exactly how that's going to be implemented, but we are very grateful for the grandfather clause. expansion states, not non-expansion states, will see the beginning of a reduction.
They got
in
a
that.
Problem.
They've
yeah.
got a problem.
No doubt.
0.5% to 3.5% is where they end. So they're kind of getting hit from all sides.
Yeah. And so let's just explain this to the audience that might not be familiar with provider taxes. These are just taxes levied at the state level on healthcare providers. The state collects money from them, essentially, which gives states then more money to tap more federal Medicaid dollars.
Correct.
And so what the federal government's saying is, you guys are kind of gaming this thing here. You're getting money from the private sector to take more money from the federal government. And they're saying they're putting an end to that. Not an end to it, but they're restricting it somewhat and reducing it.
It's been interesting. I mean, we've heard terms like gimmick and scheme and things like that. I mean, I think the way we view it is we have voluntarily chosen to be taxed.
Yeah.
So that way the money does not come from the general fund. That way that money that would have otherwise come from the general fund can go to fund other things in Mississippi that need to be funded. Hospitals are willing to tax themselves to the tune of about $475 million dollars in order to pull down federal money that frankly, accounts for uncompensated care that we're required to provide.
Yeah.
I mean, that's part of the problem. I know you're a free market guy. I like the free market too, and we just don't exist in that.
I know. I mean, I agree with that.
You know, I know. I've heard you talk about it before, but you know, with EMTALA, we are required to screen and treat any patient that comes through to our ER, and that costs money. And a lot of Mississippians, a lot of working Mississippians, don't have insurance. I talked to a hospital CEO not too long ago who saw 11. He used these stats. He saw 11 people come through the ER. 9 of them were working, and there were people working in his community. It was Louisville, actually, a small community.
Mm-hmm.
So I mean, he knows these people. He knows that they have jobs and they're, you know, just trying to make ends meet, and they don't have insurance. And he's got to screen and treat them, and he wants to screen and treat them
because
they're people that go to church with him and shop at the grocery store and whatever else. So.
And many workers in Mississippi, we don't have a lot of large companies that typically offer health insurance as part of their compensation and their employment package. There's lots of small, mid-sized businesses that find it cost prohibitive.
That's right.
And just don't offer it. So they're on their own, essentially. So they're working, but they don't have access to commercial insurance through their employer.
That's right.
Which is where most people in this country get their insurance.
That's right. I've never experienced not having insurance. I can't imagine how taxing that would be on a family, and it's draining hospitals. I mean, it really is. It's a very difficult situation that we're in.
Yeah, it is.
Which is part of the reason why the exchange has been so important.
Yeah, we'll get to that in the next segment. We've got Leah Smith, General Counsel and Vice President for Policy and Advocacy for the Mississippi Hospital Association in the Element Well studio. We're coming right back.
This show was previously recorded.
Be sure and check.
This show was previously recorded.
And now, the talk that keeps Mississippi talking.
Now, on to the real part.
Dynamite!
On Super Talk Mississippi.
All right, the Queen of Soul bumping us into this segment here, the great Aretha Franklin. Leah Smith, General Counsel, Vice President for Policy and Advocacy for the Mississippi Hospital Association, is our guest in the Element Well studio. So the House leadership just announced after the Senate, we just learned, passed a big, beautiful bill. Rhino, you told us there were 3 nays, Collins, Paul, and Johnson? Is that right?
Oh, Tillis,
right. Pardon me, Johnson, he came around. How could I forget Tillis? Because he's been all over the news having opposed the legislation, and the president lit into him, and then he said, okay, I'm not running again.
That's right.
He kind of solved that problem. All right, but we're just looking at now the announcement coming from the House side, Leah, is that we think we got a deal that they can get through. That's what what House leadership that was just put up on the screen here. So
I'll tell you what, this is my first time on Super Talk, and I came at the exact wrong time because the bill is changing like every 5 minutes. So
I know, and you and I were talking
working
about
with it.
I know, but something that's important in Mississippi is a rural hospital stabilization fund. Explain that. We're not sure where that landed right now.
That's
there was
right.
a difference in the House and the Senate version. There was some discussion about that. I'm not sure if the parliamentarian had to get involved in that one or not.
So
but talk about that.
I would love to, and I'll talk about the parliamentarian separately. That's been so interesting to learn about the Byrd rule and the Byrd bath and all of that sort of stuff. But, you know, with this rural hospital transformation fund, we were so glad to see it included. It's so important for a state like Mississippi that, you know, pretty much all of our hospitals are considered rural in one way or another, and will benefit. Many of them will benefit from this fund. You know, the major problem with it, the House, I think, recommended $15 billion. The Senate landed on $25 billion when they got through the Senate Finance Committee. I had read 30 minutes ago that in an effort to appease Senator Collins, they were moving to $50 billion. Now, maybe that didn't get through, and that's where the no vote came for. So I'm not really sure. But the major issue is it's a one-off program. So, I mean, the way that it's going to work under the $25 billion scenario is it's $10 billion in 2028, $10 billion in 2029, $2 billion the next 2 years, and then $1 billion. And then it's gone. And I think that this is something that our CEO, Richard Robertson, has talked about with you before. But one of the challenges, like any business, is you have to be able to plan.
Sure.
And I think hospitals keep getting the rules changed. There's a new program. There's an old the program's going away. The program's coming online in 5 years. You know, there's no way to hire a doctor and say, all right, we're going to keep you for 4 years. And then in 2032 or whatever, we're going to have to let you go.
Yeah,
I mean, that's not a good business practice. And so I think what we have tried to advocate for is pick a program and let's just stay with it. Let's just stay with whatever we're going to do. And that way we know what we need to budget for. And the off ramps are helpful. Knowing these extended time frames are helpful, but we have to be able to plan. And that just hasn't been that has not been in the cards for hospitals across the nation, really, but, you know, Mississippi.
The House proposed $15
billion. Okay.
The Senate amended that to $25
Okay.
over 5 years.
That's right.
Susan Collins, who, Rhino, you just informed us was a nay vote, she wanted $100 billion.
Okay.
Is what she wanted. So I'm thinking that maybe she opposed the bill because it didn't get to the $100 billion that she wanted.
I think that's probably true.
Yeah.
I did read a stat this morning from the National Rural Health Association. I've not vetted it, but it said that we're only going to make up 43% of what rural hospitals are going to lose under the bill in Mississippi with the $25 billion. So, you know, with the state-directed payment losses, with the DSH payment losses, with the health insurance exchange issues.
Let's talk about that. Keep going, but let's get to that.
Yeah, I just, you know, all of those things collectively are going to be a really big hit over time.
Okay.
And that's the issue. But look, grateful for it. Glad it made it in there. The conversations really started about a week ago. We've been sending correspondence almost daily to staffers and our senators. And we got word that there might be a fund, and we were very grateful for it. So we're glad it's in there.
So how do the hospitals tap that fund? How do they qualify for that? What's the process? I'm sure it's arduous at best.
Well, it probably is, and that was one of our concerns, is that many of these sort of one-off programs have a lot of hitches, and we're just going to have to see how that shakes down in regulations. I do know the way that it's going to be allocated is half is going to be allocated to the states just equally, and then half is going to be based on CMS discretion. We are not big fans of that.
Okay.
We would like for Congress to say what's rural, so that way we know that Mississippi is going to be included, because how could almost all of our hospitals not be included?
Right.
And so we would prefer not to give that to the agency discretion. But right now, half the fund is left to the agency. So we don't know details other than that.
Okay. So we were talking about EMTALA. Of course, I always remind the audience this was passed and signed into law by Ronald Reagan. A lot of people
That's
don't
right.
realize that.
That's right.
The emergency Medical and Labor Treatment Act. I think I got it right.
Yeah. The acronym. Yeah. Yes.
Bottom line is, if you show up at the ER and there's some sort of urgent medical condition, or you're in labor, the hospital is required to stabilize the patient, essentially.
And transfer them or do whatever they need to do.
Yeah. And back in the old days, I've researched this extensively. They dump them on the public county hospitals where the care, honestly, was subpar.
Right.
But they'd get them out of the better private hospitals. And that's a requirement if they, I believe, participate in Medicare, if I'm not mistaken.
That's
correct. So to stay in the program. So it's the only industry I know of where you're required to deliver services to someone even if they can't pay. There's really none other. So on that basis, I've said it many times on the show, we really don't have a free market in healthcare until an ER could say, oh, can you pay? Well, if you can't pay, I'm sorry, we can't take care of you.
That's right.
That doesn't happen in this country. Doesn't happen in Mississippi.
That's exactly right. And you know, I would say I've worked with the hospitals for 5 or 6 years in my previous role with the lieutenant governor, but I've worked with them so much more closely, and I can definitively say they want to care for people.
Sure.
I mean, it's not as if when people walk into an ER, they want to leave them desolate. They want to help them. They also want to keep the hospital open. And they want to keep service lines that are needed in the community open. And they want to recruit a new physician to care for more. They want to do all these things. So it is. It's very difficult. And it is not a free market. And that's why things like CON still exist, which we might talk about later. And will likely come up again next year. And we are in favor of reform. But in order to get rid of things like that, we also have to exist in a true free market, because otherwise we don't have the payer mix that supports keeping a business open that's underwater.
I understand.
And in 2023, we really saw a situation. I mean, I was actually on the campaign trail in 2023. So imagine being on the campaign trail and having to answer questions about hospitals that are failing. You know, thank goodness that was remedied in the fall with enhanced MHAP, and that's all good. But on the campaign trail, it was hard to answer those questions. You know, how are we going to save the hospital in my community? And hospitals are changing. I have been so impressed with how open our hospitals are to talking about their business models, or how they can work together, or how we can share information and reduce costs. But we're the lowest cost in the nation. I mean, that is the truth. We are the lowest cost in the nation, and we're about mid-range related to care. So we are providing excellent care at a very low cost. It's a revenue issue.
And so the reason I brought this MTALA issue up, and you did a great job of expanding on that, was because of what you pointed out earlier in our discussion, that just the large number of uninsured in our population. And it's likely that number is going to be boosted with these reforms that are coming out of the bill. One of those reforms that would affect Mississippi, of course, is that the enhanced subsidies in the ACA marketplaces, the exchanges, those expire at the end of this year. I just researched this a couple of weeks ago. I was a little shocked to learn that the ACA enrollment in Mississippi, just as it has across the country, is increased substantially to like over 300,000.
Yes.
330,000, I think, is the last figure I saw, of which 270,000 receive some sort of credits, of subsidies from the federal government for that coverage. But it is expected that many will drop their coverage because they'll have to come out of pocket with more when the enhanced subsidies are terminated or expired at the end of the year. And that could, again, bolster our uninsured population, which could be a problem for hospitals, could it not?
Absolutely. It's a huge problem. I mean, you know, they're not going to be able to pay. And if they have the insurance, it's junk insurance because they can't afford the out-of-pocket cost.
We got a break right now. If you can hang around, we'll continue this discussion.
Happy to.
All right. We got Leah Smith, General Counsel, Vice President for Policy and Advocacy with the Mississippi Hospital Association.
This show was previously recorded.
The one
was previously recorded.
Bring it on!
Middays with Gerard Gibbert.
It is on!
On- on Super Talk Mississippi.
Everyone, it's middays from the Element Well studio. So we went to break, Leah. We were just talking about how we might see the roles of uninsured shrink from losing the enhanced subsidies in the Affordable Care Act. Now, the latest estimates by the CBO are that some 12 million or so are going to lose coverage from all the various reforms,
right.
Medicaid, Medicare, and, of course, the ACA exchanges. But Mississippi, you know, there was a time period where kind of 100,000 was sort of the average per year. But with the enhanced subsidies and, I think, more insurers participating in our exchanges, and probably more importantly, and let you talk about this, more providers are now in network and accepting, right, the coverage sold on the exchanges. For a while, yeah, you could get coverage, but you had to pay out of pocket before you left the doctor's office or the hospital or have some other arrangement and then get reimbursed.
It was essentially junk insurance.
Yeah, it was terrible.
And so providers didn't want to participate.
Well, that's improved a lot.
It is totally improved, and I think the pandemic really had a huge impact in that. I mean, not only did the subsidies occur because of the pandemic, but also I think people got really interested in their health care, and they got interested in the ways that they could pay for their health care. And this came along, I think government started paying attention to the exchange.
Right. Yep.
That's why we saw so much talk of it in 2024 when we were going through some of the Medicaid expansion debates. I mean, the exchange was a huge part of that. The subsidies were a huge part of that. So I think letting it go is going to be hard on Mississippians. It's going to be hard on hospitals.
24 million nationally enrolled, last I checked at KFF, in the exchanges. Wasn't too long ago, it was 10 million.
That's right. That's
like 7-8 years ago, it was 10 million.
Which I think is shows that people want to take care of their health care. You don't want to, none of us want to go to the doctor and not be able to afford it.
Yeah.
I mean, I've talked to people who have been either on Medicaid and kind of been looked at a different way, or have not been able to pay for their health care. And it's an embarrassing, I mean, it's a thing that you don't want to happen to you when you're trying to take care of things in your life. So I do think that there are working people in Mississippi that want to find a way, even if they're cost sharing, even if the cost sharing goes up a little bit.
Which is planned in the bill, right? For Medicaid.
That's right, for Medicaid. But, you know, on the subsidies, I'm wondering if there would be room for, you know, taking down, for example, you were talking about 400% of the federal poverty level. That may be too high.
Yeah.
That may be too high for subsidies. Maybe we take that down a little bit. Maybe we increase cost sharing a little bit. But to just do away with them, I think would be really problematic, not only for hospitals, but for patients.
Hmm. Yeah, and that's something else, the cost-sharing subsidies that, you know, the president has sought to reduce. And then what happened is all the insurers sort of restructured their plans around that so that there would be less out-of-pocket costs, right?
That's right.
So they could get premium reimbursement.
That's right.
Yeah.
So it's a big change. It's a big change.
So what are hospitals doing? I mean, you represent the Hospital Association. What are you guys doing to kind of prepare for all these changes? Because it's a lot, as we've talked about here.
It is a lot. I think that we are going to have to see what ultimately passes, which looks like it could be fairly quickly here, which surprises me, actually. I thought there would be more maybe debate in the House. It's going to take some time, maybe a year, to roll out CMS regulations on all of these things.
Gotta code it.
So we're going to have to, that's exactly right. So we're going to have to figure out, you know, what that means, for example, in terms of our provider tax. Can we restructure?
Yeah.
Are there things we can do even within that limit that we're going to be grandfathered in at? And then our hospitals are very aware, even with the state directed payment program enhancement that happened in 2023, they were very aware that that could go away at any moment. So they have.
But isn't it, I don't mean to interrupt you, Leah, but isn't it fair to say that maybe some hospitals, particularly our rural hospitals, were on the edge and not have survived without that.
100%. I mean, we had three or four, and this is just from knowing health policy, being on the campaign and not being with MHA. There were three or four hospitals that were on the brink of shutting down. Even our larger systems were struggling. Service lines were closing. We had other big, big issues like Greenwood and places like that that, you know, were really struggling, and they were really helped out by the enhanced MHAP. So and they're doing fine. Hospitals are doing okay right now in Mississippi.
Okay.
And they're adding where they need to. You know, they're adding a service line. They're partnering together. I just saw not too long ago that Tyler Holmes, for example, has partnered with Baptist to add cardiovascular services.
Okay.
So that is one thing they're doing. They're figuring out how to cut costs, how to work together to provide services, share workforce. Share information. That has been a really big thing at MHA. We are trying to figure out how to leverage AI, health information, so that we can be efficient in transfers, for example.
Okay.
So that we can identify, for example, patients who are going to the ER more than four times a year and redirect them somewhere else, you know, so that they are getting general health care and they're not showing up in the ER for a flu situation.
Sure.
And we can do all of these things with technology. We're building a lot of that out. But I think that hospitals have always known that the average commercial rate was fragile, that it could go away. And I think for that reason, they have planned accordingly. They haven't been spending or acquiring or trying to add where they might have to completely cut in a couple of years. But still, it's a blow, and it's going to be hard on hospitals.
What are you going to be talking to the legislature about this coming session?
So, you know, I think the payer mix is always at issue. There might be some other creative ways we could deal with that. And I've had some broad conversations with Chairman Creekmore about this and Chairman Brian. You know, I think that CON is back on the table. I think we'll probably see a bill kind of like what was vetoed this year because of the one issue with one hospital. We would like to see that bill go a little bit further. We liked the House version that allowed hospitals to do things like dialysis. If we are going to require hospitals to see and treat patients that can't pay, we should also allow hospitals to perform services that typically do pay. And not only that, but it's good for patients to have a choice. If they want to stay in their hospital with their other providers to receive that treatment, then they should be allowed to do that. And right now they can't.
So what's the official position of MHA on CON reform in general? I mean, are you for complete repeal of all CON or limited? Tell us about that.
So with the payer mix issues, you know, we feel like CONs need to remain intact in some form because we don't have the benefit of having all patients that pay.
Okay.
But having said that, we believe in reforms, and we worked closely with Chairman Creekmore and Chairman Brian on that bill. We worked closely with Kevin Blackwell. For example, the CapEx expenditure thresholds are too low.
Yeah.
I mean, right now it's $1.5 million on equipment.
To pave a parking lot. I mean, that's ridiculous.
Or buy a piece of healthcare equipment.
Yeah, it's ridiculous.
We have far exceeded $1.5 million.
Sure.
We should have had a growth rate in there. We do to some extent, but it has been applied in sort of a wonky way. And so we believe that we need to raise that and add a growth rate for clinical, non-clinical, and for medical equipment. We are fully on board. We also believe in a level playing field.
Okay.
So everybody needs to play by the same rules, and right now we don't necessarily
have. Okay, so the House bill you guys were in support of, came out this year.
We in fact liked the original version of the House bill that kind of went a little bit further
reform. Yeah,
yep.
Exactly.
Yep.
Well, you know, that's going to be a big topic again in this session.
Will. And I think it will. Talk to Chairman Creekmore about it the other day.
Yeah, and perhaps it will include even additional reform as well.
You never know.
Okay.
You know,
but your members are okay with that.
We are always willing to look at reform. We know that things don't need to remain stagnant.
Well, a whole lot of folks in white coats show up, as you know, in those committee meetings that oppose it.
You know, you would be surprised. I mean, we really didn't have a lot of opposition to the bill that was at issue this year.
Okay.
And I think that's just because we all worked it out and talked about it in advance. And we knew knew that there wasn't going to be wholesale repeal because we're still dealing with that payer mix issue. And we know that
We'll work on that.
it might be on the table at some point.
But Senator Bryan doesn't seem to be in favor of anything.
You know what? He was fully in favor of the bill that he and Sam Creekmore negotiated together. And he was great about it. I think he understands that. I'm not going to speak for him, but I think we all understand that a threshold of $1.5 million, for example, on medical equipment is going to change over
time. That's a
no-brainer. It has to.
Yeah,
that's right.
That's an easy one, though.
That's right.
But we, I think we can go further than that, don't you?
We will definitely be working on it.
We'll keep talking about that. I appreciate you coming in, Leah. Enjoyed
Thank you.
It. Thank you a
Me
lot.
Too.
Yeah. Leah Smith, General Counsel and Vice President for Policy and Advocacy for the Mississippi Hospital Association. She's been our guest in the Element Well studio, another segment in this hour. And then in the afternoon portion of Middays, it's Aaron Rice, founder and CEO of American Dream Legal.
When the clock strikes 12, we'll cool off and start a rock.
This show was previously recorded.
Poly Up of Mississippi.
This show was previously recorded.
Come on. Come on.
Middays with Gerard Gibbert.
All right, we are back.
On Super Talk Mississippi.
Welcome back, everyone. It's Middays. We're coming at you from the Element Well studio. So, Senator Elissa Slotkin from the great state of Michigan, not a big fan of the big, beautiful bill, it's fair to say. And, you know, we've been talking quite a bit about how it seems like the central theme of the objection by Democrats to the bill is the changes to health care reforms. So listen to what Senator Slotkin says.
I did a little math. If you're a family of four in Lansing, Michigan, making a total of $129,000 total, and you're on the Obamacare ACA marketplace, your bill will go up by $5,500 next year. That's a 52% increase in your health care bills. If you are Joe and Nancy from Lansing, Michigan, 60 years old, your kids are out of the house, they're grown, you make $82,000 a year total between the two of you, your health care costs, if you're on the marketplace, will go up by $13,000. That is 197% increase in your health care bills. So what are Joe and Nancy going to do? Are you going to pay for health care if it goes up by 197%? Think of your own health care. No. Joe and Nancy are going to be at risk for being off health care. And the combined cuts between Medicaid and Obamacare and the price of everyone else's insurance going up, we believe that enough people are going to be kicked off that it's going to feel really close to 2010, when the number one cause for bankruptcy in the United States of America was medical debt because people don't have insurance.
So, you know, I've often talked about how these politicians take advantage. That's a bunch of numbers and figures in that discussion, right? And most people just glaze over. And they take advantage of the fact that most people really don't know what she's talking about, except they did key in on, wow, my insurance is going up $7,000 or whatever it was, the first example.
I think it was $13,000.
Okay. So I think that's right. It's a family of four example. She did a family of four, then a couple, then an individual. So, but it lacks context, as the left likes to say. And I'm going to explain it to you. First, you hear those numbers, like, where did she come up with that figure? Like I don't remember the exact, like 129,000 or something like that for the family of four. And that kind of triggered a little memory in my head and started doing the research on this yesterday. So here's the explanation. That happens to be exactly 400% of the federal poverty level. Why is that important? Because the way the subsidies are structured in the ACA marketplaces, the so-called Obamacare exchanges, where you can buy coverage and receive a subsidy from the government to pay for it, and it's calculated to limit your out-of-pocket premium cost to a percentage of your income, starting at 100% of the federal poverty level up to 400%. But if you make a dollar more than 400%, you lose the subsidy. That's known as the subsidy cliff, is what it's referred to. This is a bit timely because we got Leah coming in from the Mississippi Hospital Association next. But what she's saying is that Joe Biden's Inflation Reduction Act, and then the American Rescue Plan, actually I got them reversed, the American Rescue Plan and then the Inflation Reduction Act, both pieces of legislation that passed early on in the Biden term, they reform the way the subsidy cliff works. Basically said you can keep buying insurance on the exchanges even if your income is above 400% of the federal poverty level. And we will still limit the premiums to whatever it is, I think 9.5% of your household income. That's what she's talking about. Now, here's the important point. All that expires, by the way. In those two bills, it was passed in the American Rescue Plan, and then it was extended in the Inflation Reduction Act. That's scheduled to expire at the end of this year. Why? Because it passed with a simple majority instead of the supermajority, the filibuster-proof, 60 votes in the Senate, and it had to limit it to pass under Elizabeth McDonough, the parliamentarian's, rules. Here's the deal. All we're doing here by allowing it to expire, Rhino, is returning to the original Obamacare policies. So now are you saying, Senator Slotkin and your Democrat colleagues, that Obamacare had bad provisions in it?
Sure seems like it.
What a hypocrite. You think she's going to explain this as I just did to the people?
No.
Not no, but hell no. I'm not even sure she can, because you watch the video, she's reading from a piece of paper that her staff gave her, right?
Yep.
She has no idea. She's just spouting numbers off. No idea the underlying reasons for why that's going to occur. So we're simply returning to Obama-era Obamacare, and they're mad about it. Fox News, Super Talk News next, then Leah Smith. Stay with us.
This show was previously recorded.
A Super Talk Mississippi Media Production.